The problem that prepares for the events of Shakespeare's Tempest is this. As Duke of Milan, Prospero devoted himself to liberal studies and neglected to govern his city. Having lost his dukedom, he has acquired supreme power on an unknown, nearly deserted island, and he must use that power to reform the politics of Naples and Milan from afar. Can Prospero's liberal arts, tempered with Machiavellian realism, right the wrongs done to himself and his daughter, secure her happiness, and establish good government? That Prospero resorts to magic to complement his powers should be no surprise. If the magic is poetry, Prospero's feat may be imitable. My lecture assumes Shakespeare's place among the great thinkers of the Western tradition as we study them at St. John's College. The Tempest is a work of poetry, the poetry of one who understands both the quarrel between philosophy and poetry and their common ground. I read Shakespeare's play, I cannot help but read it, in the context of Plato's Republic, Machiavelli's The Prince, Montaigne's essay on cannibals, and numerous other great works. Shakespeare does not present us with a treatise, and I will not treat The Tempest as a treatise in dramatic form. I do not claim to know what Shakespeare read and what he didn't. But Shakespeare's Prospero is a ruler educated in the liberal arts and confronted with a political problem that resembles those of other cities, nations, and times. The solution he presents to that problem is a poetic solution involving images that shape the understanding of the characters and susceptible members of the audience. The idea that Prospero has some kinship with Shakespeare himself is not hard to establish, and I will exploit it. Shakespeare and his Prospero devise theatrical images to address problems that are surmountable neither by force nor by reason alone. Theater, poetic action, offers possibilities invisible elsewhere, but nevertheless compelling to a receptive audience. I hope I can persuade those of you who worry that poetry is not appropriately appreciated when it is understood as a product of profound thought about matters of great and enduring human concern. Now, a quick summary of the context of The Tempest in political thought. In the Republic, Plato opens up a way to live in accord with possibilities unrealizable within the cave of any actual political community. Justice is to be sought in the proper order of one's soul. There may be no visible external support for a just life, but it is at least thinkable that there is cosmic support of some kind. While one may continue to seek a cosmic order that ultimately supports true justice and punishes injustice, one must acknowledge that ordinary political life is in unresolvable tension with this order. The city that reflects the just order comes to light in speech or logos, and speech alone cannot govern irrational humans. In effect, anyone who finds the goodness of justice as Plato presents it compelling must live simultaneously in two cities, the real city and the city in speech. Christian doctrine enhances the tension between the two cities of the Republic. The city in speech is transformed into the heavenly city, inaccessible to humans in their fallen state. Christianity places divine authority beyond the reach of the human intellect and demotes the authority of reason. The effective but superhuman standard for human action is set by God and is unchallengeable. Men who enforce his authority have a breath of power unheard of before. By contrast, those who submit, awed by supernatural claims, are essentially powerless. The possible is in the hands of the omnipotent one, while humans act within narrow constraints, and even the most conscientious do not escape evil. In response to Plato and to Christianity, Machiavelli opens up greater possibilities for human action by debunking what he calls imaginary republics and emphasizing the effectual truth. Strong, clever humans can assess their circumstances and respond accordingly, pursuing the goods they choose without cosmic guidance toward the true or perfect good. The world Shakespeare depicts in The Tempest reflects Machiavelli's innovation. When Caliban finds a new master, he believes himself to be a new man. In his submissiveness, Caliban resembles the ordinary man, a member of the group Machiavelli dubs the people. During the course of the play, Prospero demonstrates his skill as the prince, who regains authority and consolidates his power. He uses whatever means are available to him to achieve his ends, including physical intimidation and the ability to awaken in others as needed, both gratitude and a sense of guilt. But, one might object, Prospero's entire island is a product of the imagination. It is a kind of theater. He was an ineffectual, if beloved, Duke of Milan, and it is not clear that he will rule effectually when he returns to Italy. Prospero's apparent reversal of the coup that supplanted his goodwill with self-interest sets a new tone, but that tone may be magical delusion, necessarily temporary, and nothing more. When he abandons his magical arts as the play approaches its end, the reader hopes, along with Prospero, that Miranda and Ferdinand will rule in accord with Prospero's guidance. It is reasonable to challenge that hope with the claim that Prospero's opponents are both more lifelike and more Machiavellian, although petty and weak in the context in which we see them. As Machiavelli recommends, they eschew good to embrace effectual means to success. On this view, the example Prospero provides during The Tempest brings delight for some, enlightenment for no one. Whether Prospero's princely character is real or fantastic is a central and rather urgent question for anyone who takes the play seriously. I will argue that Prospero has in fact raised a new standard for the government of cities everywhere. I have outlined the context in which Shakespeare's art and Prospero's emerges as a response to Machiavelli's teaching, and I will argue that The Tempest is a cogent response. The play is complex. While it reflects Machiavelli's teaching, or a reading of it, it resembles Plato's poetry as well. Is Shakespeare offering a post-Machiavellian revival of Platonic political thought? This lecture will have three parts. One, Prospero, poet king or Machiavellian prince? Two, Machiavellian conspirators and not so Machiavellian dreams. Three, Prospero's victory, reformation of the Italian regime. Part one, Prospero, poet king or Machiavellian prince? In the first 60 lines of the play, the word good is used 6 times. This is rather surprising, since only bad things seem to be happening. The tempest is whipping up gale force winds. The boatswain is frantically yelling useless orders, and except for Gonzalo, who has hope, the speakers expect soon to be drowned. Gonzalo bases his hopes solely on the impression that the boatswain's fate is to die on the gallows. The scene culminates with Antonio loyally declaiming, "Let's all sink with the king," and Gonzalo praying, "The wills above be done, but I would fain die a dry death." The question naturally arises, where is good to be found? The rest of The Tempest is a response. Near the end of the play, Gonzalo summarizes all the goods he sees resulting from the voyage he and the rulers of Milan and Naples recently undertook. I'm quoting, "Oh, rejoice beyond a common joy, and set it down with gold on lasting pillars. In one voyage did Clarabel her husband find at Tunis, and Ferdinand her brother found a wife where he himself was lost. Prospero his dukedom in a poor isle, and all of us ourselves when no man was his own." End quote. Only Clarabel's marriage was achieved without Prospero's aid, and it is unclear whether that furthers anything but her father's ambition. When Gonzalo refers to the shipwreck's lack of self-possession, he is talking about their moral condition. Their futile wanderings on the island reflect their moral perplexity, and the end of the play constitutes a kind of moral clearing contrived by Prospero. The short version of the response the play offers then seems to be, the good is nowhere unless it is contrived. Left to their own devices, Caliban, his short-term ally and fellow drunk Stefano, and then happy Trinculo, would guzzle, squabble, and bungle everything. Sebastian, under Antonio's influence, would perpetrate evil and then suffer it, while Gonzalo and the grief-stricken Alonso would be unable to defend themselves. Miranda's good nature, by contrast, provides a basis for hope and a motive for action. In 1-2, Prospero avers he has done nothing but in care of her. But he knows that without two things, a lover she deems worthy of her love and a way back to civilized society, she will not be happy. Everyone's chance for a good life depends upon Prospero's art. The long-established habits of the rightful Duke of Milan are primarily contemplative. He still prizes his books above his dukedom and cannot be shared by the little society of the island, much less by his city and country. His magic is only as good as the end it serves, and Prospero alone chooses those ends. There is no sign of divine guidance. If the outcome of the adventure all the characters share on the island is good, it is due to Prospero's design and the machinations he undertakes to fulfill it. Much has, of course, been said by anyone who attempts to interpret The Tempest about Prospero. He is wise, perhaps too wise to be believable. Even if he is not a representative of Shakespeare himself, his art undeniably resembles the art of the theater. Like Shakespeare, Prospero contrives scenes in which characters display themselves both to the audience and to one another, and, at least in Alonso's case, finally come to recognize themselves. It is Prospero who arranges events to highlight the weaknesses in each of their natures. Prospero's moral manipulation of the others serves personal as well as public-spirited ends. For example, after presenting Alonso and Antonio with an undeniable summary of their crimes, he demands that they return to him his dukedom, and they do. After exposing their responsibility for the injuries they did to him and his daughter, Prospero exhibits his power by reprieving them from further punishment. Among the shipwrecks, none but Sebastian and Antonio know of their treachery, since Prospero chooses not to announce it, and Ferdinand's marriage to Miranda will confirm the new alliance between Prospero and Alonso, King of Naples. If Prospero's work endures, his line will indeed be prosperous. Is it they who will unify and rule Italy? Prospero's evident, if still incomplete, success at the end of the play raises a question that may be put this way. Is he, the true Machiavellian prince, superior in virtù to the obvious Machiavellian characters, or is his art a refutation of Machiavellianism? The evidence for his virtù, in brief, is as follows. By means of a magical tempest which allows him to reshape the imaginations of several of the major figures in the contemporary Italian political world, Prospero reclaims his dukedom and places his only offspring in the line of succession to the throne. He quells two rebellions in the making and subdues the initiator of the current plot against his own life, reforming him into an apologetic servant, grateful for any mercy he may be shown. Prospero's familiarity with Machiavellian machinations is obvious. The violence he perpetrates and exploits is unreal, all noise and images, but the fraud is undeniable. Prospero is victorious in part because he understands Alonso's and Ferdinand's familial love and his daughter's and Ferdinand's romantic love, both of which he expertly manipulates. He poses as an ogre who cares nothing for Miranda's love or her lover, and he laments his own loss to arouse Alonso's pity before he shows him the wonder that his son still lives. Ferdinand then makes clear that he has already accepted Prospero as a substitute father. Alonso can hardly object. Prospero honors Gonzalo for his goodness and apparently agrees with him about the existence of some sort of providence. But unlike Gonzalo, he trusts no one and nothing, not even his daughter. At the start of the play, it is clear that he has kept her in the dark about her identity until the right time, as he judges it, and puts her to sleep when her pity might interfere with his plot. Even his tricksy spirit, Ariel, is not the recipient of his full trust. Compulsion assures him of Ariel's help, although there is a real affection between them. Caliban finally submits to Prospero only because he must. These facts suggest qualities that would indeed characterize a Machiavellian prince. A thoroughgoing Machiavellian account of Prospero's rule would entail the claim that he seeks primarily, if not exclusively, to recover the power he lost in Milan and to extend it. A Machiavellian Prospero cares for Miranda's good, if at all, insofar as it accords with those aims. She is an extension of himself and his line. It is clear that Prospero learned from his brother's treachery to take practical politics seriously, and his skill is evident in the course of the play. If Prospero's conclusion is simply that he was imprudent and foolish to trust, there is no need for him to look to any external standard or principle, a sort of looking Machiavelli denigrates. But Prospero speaks of the betrayal in decidedly un-Machiavellian language. He says he loved Antonio dearly. Out of love, Prospero reveals, he trusted Antonio, and Antonio acted unworthily. Prospero admires nobility, perhaps for its own sake, and finds baseness repulsive. In his talk with Miranda in 1-2, Prospero calls Antonio's reduction of Naples to a tributary city to Milan, ignoble. Alonso, his inveterate enemy, exploited Antonio's betrayal, but then recognized that they could not get away with killing Prospero because of the people's love for him. The emphasis on nobility and the critique of base ambition are suited to Miranda's moral views, the views Prospero's education has inculcated in her receptive nature. He has brought up his daughter with a clear sense of right and wrong, high and low, rather than a Machiavellian conviction that to do well, one must exploit that sense in others. Of course, a Machiavellian father needn't believe everything he teaches his young daughter in the hopes of keeping her, like other subjects, both malleable and content. There are persuasive reasons, however, to think that what moves Prospero is, in fact, love. Not only for his own marriageable young daughter, a love I am confident he feels, but also love for the good. Prospero's art creates new circumstances. His way of governing substitutes benevolence for justice. He defends the possibility that the good is independent of the interests of individuals and that it can be made effectual, the very notion that Machiavellian virtù attacks. In The Tempest, Prospero's convictions are translated into action and extend the realm of the possible to include a hopeful future that was closed off by the betrayals of Antonio and his ilk. For 12 years, Prospero's main undertaking, beyond assuring their survival, has been to educate his daughter. In doing so, he has evidently aimed at a future good that could be shared. He has acted not primarily out of the sense of wounded honor, which he has and will cure in the course of the play, but to be a father and a ruler worthy of those names. Hear how he expresses himself in his acceptance of Ferdinand as his future son-in-law. If I have too austerely punished you, your compensation makes amends, for I have given you a third of mine own life, or that for which I live, who once again I tender to thy hand. All thy vexations were but my trials of thy love, and thou hast strangely stood the test. Do not smile that I boast her off, for thou shalt find she will outstrip all praise and make it halt behind her. This is the language of a man who genuinely loves and admires his daughter for something other than the benefits she brings him. Prospero expects his son-in-law to second, not to supplant, that love. Prospero did learn something about political necessity from losing his dukedom. His words suggest he learned something different from his daughter. Her infant trust and cheerfulness when they were abandoned to the sea rescued him from despair, he says. Later, fortune showed him the island they were to make their home, and Prospero acted not only to secure Miranda's present well-being, he educated her for a full and complete life that must at first have seemed not merely elusive, but illusory. Before Alonso's fleet passed by, the difficulty of returning to civilized society looked insurmountable. Moreover, even the island was not free from evil. Prospero adopted the one prior, at least half-human, inhabitant, Caliban, who before long exhibited a tainted nature by attempting to rape Miranda. None of this overwhelms Prospero's hope. Is this mere stubbornness or a conviction that there is an effectual good, some sort of providence? When Prospero was thrust from his dukedom, Miranda's trust and her cheerfulness saved her father from despair, and it is her good nature that continues to keep Prospero optimistic. Goodness in her is providential. In imitation of her father's early efforts and under his guidance, Miranda undertook to educate Caliban. This project arose from her generous nature. Caliban's tainted nature showed itself in his response. As Caliban eloquently puts it, quote, "You taught me language, and my profit on it is I know how to curse," end quote. Prospero responded to the difference in their natures by learning how to subdue the evil in Caliban to make him serve his and Miranda's good. With vigilance and the skillful exploitation of malleable spirits, he has made Caliban a useful slave. It may have been more prudent for Prospero to kill Caliban or to exile him from the island, but he has done neither, and Caliban remains a potential threat to Miranda and to himself. Prospero's apparent imprudence makes sense if he accepts Caliban all along, not only as, quote, "a thing of darkness," end quote, but somehow as his own. Prospero strives to be fair and honest, not merely superior in power. He must know that evil is often bound up with good. Caliban's mixed nature is noted by Stefano and Trinculo as well as by Prospero. He smells fish-like. He looks more or less human. They call him a devil and a moon calf, most often a monster. Stefano and Trinculo ally with Caliban because they believe he could be useful to them. Perhaps they respond, too, to Caliban's speech. For when he is not cursing, he really is eloquent. I'm quoting, "Be not afeard," he tells his drunken companions. "The isle is full of noises, sounds and sweet airs that give delight and hurt not. Sometimes 1,000 twanging instruments will hum about mine ears, and sometimes voices that, if I then had waked after long sleep, will make me sleep again. And then, in dreaming, the clouds, methought, would open and show riches ready to drop upon me, that when I waked, I cried to dream again." End quote. Here, and in response to the array of humans who appear to him, as to Miranda, splendid, Caliban exhibits a kind of greedy wonder. While her wonder promotes love, his makes him both gullible and servile. He proclaims himself free when he has only found a new master to follow. Later, Caliban chides himself for his sycophancy toward the drunken butler, Stefano. I'm quoting, "What a thrice double ass was I to take this drunkard for a god and worship this dull fool," end quote. The contrast with Prospero is marked. But Caliban's active imagination is thoroughly enslaved to his hatred of his master until he is subdued near the end of the play. He is bent on revenge, and despite his lack of self-mastery, calls himself the rightful master of the island simply because he was there first. If Caliban's apparent reform in Act 5 is real, I'll be wise hereafter, he says, and seek for grace. End quote. Prospero's power is great indeed. Most likely, Caliban will rebel again and again. But Prospero treats him as a being capable of moral choice, not a commodity. Stefano, Trinculo, Antonio, too, only wonder how much money they could make displaying him in public as an oddity. Prospero's relations with Ariel help further to illuminate his moral integrity. Years before the play, Ariel refused to obey the abhorred commands of Sycorax, the witch who gave birth to Caliban, and therefore he suffered torments at her hands. Presumably, he is repelled by evil. Prospero won authority over Ariel by freeing him from a tree trunk, and he evidently reminds Ariel of that fact regularly. Ariel, in turn, acknowledges that he owes loyal service to Prospero and serves him in the hope of complete liberty, but he gracefully accepts Prospero's mastery until Prospero abandons it. While he is a very demanding master, Prospero never coerces his spirit servant. He doesn't need to, for Ariel seeks his love and serves him devotedly. At the same time, Ariel feels free to correct his master. Consider this exchange between them in 5:1. Ariel, your charm so strongly works him that if you now beheld them, your affections would become tender. Prospero, dost thou think so, spirit? Ariel, mine would, sir, were I human. Prospero, and mine shall. Hast thou, which art but air, a touch, a feeling of their afflictions, and shall not myself, one of their kind, that relish all as sharply, passion as they, be kindlier than thou art? Though with their high wrongs I am struck to the quick, yet with my nobler reason against my fury do I take part. The rarer action is in virtue than in vengeance. They being penitent, the sole drift of my purpose doth extend, not a frown further. End quote. Although he was tempted to pursue it, I believe, Prospero forgoes revenge. Ariel's prompting converts his self-serving rage to generosity, and he loves Ariel dearly, as he acknowledges when Ariel asks. Without Ariel, it is difficult to see how Prospero could have achieved control over the travelers that make his project workable. Ariel whips up the tempest without harming even a hair on the head of any of those who suffer through it. He interrupts the plot Antonio forms with Sebastian to kill Alonso and Antonio. He casts a spell on the nobles and lures them to Prospero's cell while he manipulates the drunken servants and Caliban. He even conjures the other spirits to perform Miranda's and Ferdinand's nuptial mask. Like Miranda, he is moved by pity, and in his case, it seems to surprise Prospero, and even to contribute to shaping his master's ends. Ariel is evidence that there is a good to which Prospero adheres. Prospero is wise, but for all his wisdom, he is not a philosopher king. He forgives his enemies, but he is no Christian prince of peace either. Rather, he allies the virtues of a Machiavellian prince with the gentleness of a merciful God who never loses sight of the virtues of his creation despite its defects. Of course, a determined Machiavellian could claim that Prospero's gentleness is in accord with necessity under the current circumstances. At another time, perhaps harshness would be more effectual. But Prospero aims at an integrity of character that he does not always see in himself, and he strives to improve. Like the more Machiavellian characters, he does not articulate the good to which he aspires. Unlike them, he is a master creator and manipulator of images, all tending toward a coherent and humane, if yet invisible, end. Part 2, Machiavellian Conspirators and Not-So-Machiavellian Dreams. There are rather obvious Machiavellian characters in The Tempest. About 12 years before the play begins, when Antonio's princely ambition overruled fraternal duty and affection so far as to lead him to exile his infant niece along with his brother Prospero, Antonio usurped the role of Duke of Milan. For all he knows, he caused the deaths of his niece and his brother. Antonio learned 12 years before the tempest begins how not to be good. And in the course of the play, he looks to embrace more fully that teaching. He corrupts Sebastian, the brother of Alonso, to whom Antonio has been paying tribute since he overthrew his own brother. Antonio has had to subordinate his own dukedom to Alonso and Naples in order to secure his power, but he would prefer to rule alone, as Machiavelli recommends. Sebastian would be indebted to him for his crown, were he to seize it when Antonio kills Alonso. Sebastian clearly lacks the princely initiative of his co-conspirator. Antonio must work to alert him to the possibility that he could seize power, as Antonio has. Then, after briefly challenging the plot with a question about conscience, which Antonio peremptorily dismisses, he says, "I feel not that deity in my bosom." Sebastian agrees to murder the good old man, Gonzalo, in his sleep while Antonio kills the king. But a moment later, Sebastian evidently has second thoughts and pauses the action of killing Alonso and Gonzalo with, quote, "but one word." The pause is just sufficient to allow Prospero's tricksy spirit, Ariel, to intervene and prevent the dual murder. Alonso was Antonio's original co-conspirator against Prospero. His arrangement of the marriage of his daughter to the king of Tunis is further evidence of his love of power. Gonzalo is a very different sort of man. His simplicity rouses the conspirators' disdain, for he seems unaware of the evil that surrounds them. Judging from his efforts to mitigate the harm done to Prospero and Miranda, he supplied them with books, clothing, and food in their exile. He might try to interfere in Antonio's and Sebastian's display of Machiavellian virtù if he has the opportunity, but Antonio seems to find him simply annoying. Evidently, Gonzalo has maintained his role as counselor for many years simply because he is kind and loyal. His imagination is receptive to the charms of the island, where theirs is blocked. He can see things to which his compatriots are blind. For example, Gonzalo is the only member of the stranded court who perceives that the storm has left them and their apparel miraculously fresh. Gonzalo expresses no grief in response to the apparent drowning of the young Prince Ferdinand, whose loss has left King Alonso weak. But Gonzalo's lack of pity evidently derives not only from his tendency to be blind to almost all evils, but from trust in the unseen goodness of Providence. In 2:1, he proclaims of Alonso's son Ferdinand, "He's sure in the island," and prays, quote, "Heaven keep him from these beasts," end quote. Just as Gonzalo's trust in Providence enabled him to hope his efforts to aid Prospero and Miranda would be effectual, so here it protects him from grief. Gonzalo shows compassion towards Ferdinand's father elsewhere when he criticizes Sebastian for his harsh judgment of Alonso for undertaking the voyage in which his daughter was married off to the king of Tunis and his son was apparently drowned. I'm quoting, "My lord Sebastian, the truth you speak doth lack some gentleness and the time to speak it in," end quote. Alonso is responsible, but not unworthy of pity. Prospero shares much with Gonzalo. When he instructs Miranda in the history of their exile, Prospero attributes their survival to Providence. The opportunity to rectify the injustice they suffered, by contrast, comes from fortune, and Prospero exploits it. Gonzalo knows little of fortune. But like the good old man, Prospero pities the culprits. The plotter's Machiavellianism is absurd. For to kill Alonso and Gonzalo when they all lack means to return home would be senseless brutality. Not only is the murder of their fellow shipwrecks stranded on an island whose resources they belittle not the recognition of political necessity, it is downright foolish. There will be no gain, for their primary target, Alonso, has virtually no one to rule. Gonzalo's vision of a return to what sounds like the life of the first human beings in Eden makes no practical sense either, but at least it has charm. Moreover, it suggests, Montaigne-like, the possibility that there is a natural basis for social good. Gonzalo's distaste for corrupt political society combines with the atmosphere of the island to promote an image of a harmonious life in accord with nature's laws alone. Gonzalo envisions a society in which power and politics would be unnecessary. Yet there is no evidence that he tried to prevent Alonso from marrying off his daughter to a stranger king in an obvious bid to expand his influence to North Africa. Perhaps Prospero's savior has been trying gently to mitigate the evils of Antonio's and Alonso's love of power. He has not influenced their characters at all. Gonzalo is an outlier, likable because he harms no one and has no evil intent. But he is dignified too, and he's not a fool. His example points to the question whether it is possible to reconcile the recognition of political realities with visionary hopes. Gonzalo's goodness is acknowledged even by his would-be killers. Next to him, the conspirators Antonio and Sebastian are manifestly despicable, while Alonso is merely pitiable. Later, we will see, Gonzalo is acutely aware of the guilt of his fellows and its effects, even while he pities them for their consequent suffering. Gonzalo is the only character apart from Prospero who has an image of a superior way of life for a community, but his political insight is severely limited. He's a dreamer, not a defender of justice and good government. Self-interest moves him so little that there is no obvious place for himself in the community he envisions. He designates himself the ruler and then eliminates government entirely. But Gonzalo doesn't worry about practicalities. The demi-monster Caliban is Gonzalo's evil counterpart. He also imagines a new state of political affairs, one that he thinks will improve upon his current miserable state. His first experience of drunkenness heightens Caliban's desire for revenge, and he manages to enlist Stefano to do his violent bidding, even while he worships him as a god. Caliban's vision is hardly coherent, but it does pose a credible threat to Prospero's life, to attend to which he must interrupt a more delightful task before it is too late. Caliban is no prince, but his willingness to use violence makes him dangerous. The success of Caliban's plot would change the entire outcome of the magical storm. Instead of Prospero correcting the injustice done to him and his daughter 12 years earlier, Caliban would exact revenge upon Prospero for enslaving him in the island, which he claims a right to possess. Prospero would have been shown, again, to be ineffectual. If Antonio and Sebastian also carried out their conspiracy, they would have to deal with Stefano Trinculo and Caliban. The competition for Miranda would lead to another contest, probably more killing, and she would lack both a protector and any chance for happiness. But for Prospero's last-minute intervention with Ariel's help, both plots may well have succeeded. Of course, Stefano's and Trinculo's attraction to the empty accoutrements of power, luxurious clothing hung out on a line to distract them, makes it easy to stop them. It also makes their plot seem thoroughly comical. Against the trap which Prospero has the wisdom to set, Caliban's warnings are ineffectual, and his image of Stefano and Miranda as king and queen of the island, with Caliban as their advisor, dissolves. These considerations and Prospero's acknowledgement of Caliban, this thing of darkness as his own, mitigate his punishment. But it would be foolish to ignore the seriousness of the threat he poses. Miranda has no place in this account of plotters. She's not even a fellow conspirator with her father. But I must say a word about her before we go on. As I have said, she provides the motive for much, if not all, that Prospero does. Miranda may be more complex than she seems. She's quickly persuaded that her father has good reasons for subjecting the rulers of Milan and Italy to the tempest, even though she pities them and later finds them, especially Ferdinand, a source of wonder. She sides with Ferdinand against her father's harsh authority, as he expected her to. showing that she has a mind, or at least passions, of her own. When she catches Ferdinand cheating at chess, though he denies it, and lets him know at the same time she forgives him. Miranda loves Ferdinand instantly and unreservedly. By contrast, she hates and fears Caliban for good reason. And she has learned from his example that beings of her own kind sometimes do gratuitous evil towards one another. The example of Gonzalo helps us to illuminate Miranda's character, for like him, she seems at first merely simple and kind. Both are unequal to the task of dealing with the duplicitous characters Prospero must confront. Since most of what looks like independence in Miranda turns out to be in accord with Prospero's plan, if not simply a product of his education, it is unclear that she will be able to grapple with political necessities. Still, although she never says what she thinks of Prospero when he acknowledges his ploys to preserve hers and Ferdinand's love, it makes sense to imagine she assents. That would imply that she also sees that Prospero accepts her so-called treachery against him. If so, she's an implicit co-conspirator, albeit after the fact. We will return to Miranda later. None of the ambitious characters in The Tempest, besides Prospero, is clever enough to succeed in his projects. None of them understands human passions in general or the idiosyncrasies of his fellows, as Prospero does. Moreover, none displays evidence of thoughtful reflection on the political ends he seeks. Prospero's governance is not merely self-serving because it is primarily designed to promote the future well-being of his daughter. For her good to thrive, as he sees it, the good of the city must be secured. Miranda will prosper when her newfound city and country do so. But none of this will occur unless Prospero can outplot his various enemies and their enemies as well. Part 3, Prospero's victory, reformation of the Italian regime. The aim of Prospero's contrivances, starting with the Tempest itself, is nothing short of a refounding of Naples as well as of Milan with his daughter and Ferdinand in the positions of authority. Prospero's careful control of Caliban, his guidance of Ariel's powers, and his exploitation of both the forces of nature and the human tendencies of his opponents all serve this end. In subduing Caliban, Prospero reverses the projected decline of regimes on the island from kingship to tyranny. This reversal may be temporary. In any case, Prospero and the others will soon set off from the island, presumably never to return. But the island and the events that have occurred on it will shape the imaginations of those who are receptive to it, that is, Gonzalo and Alonso, as well as Miranda, Ferdinand, and perhaps in some measure Caliban. We don't know about Sebastian. I count Antonio a lost cause. Like Shakespeare, Prospero has embraced the imagination not merely as a tool for his ambitions, but as a source of understanding and even a guide for action. The inspiration for him to do so was itself the work of a passion that can't take hold without imagination, namely love. The whole plot of The Tempest depends upon love. Alonso loves and grieves for his son, forgetting his concern with power. In this frame of mind, he later gives up his ancient enmity for Prospero. He repents of the evil he has done, and he embraces his daughter-in-law. Ariel loves Prospero and desires to be loved by him, and therefore does his bidding meticulously. Because Prospero loves his daughter, he undertakes the whole project of the play. Ferdinand and Miranda declare their independence of their fathers under the watchful eye of Prospero, who expects and welcomes their love. The two Machiavellian subplots of the play, Antonio's and Sebastian's conspiracy, and the plot Caliban forms in his drunken alliance with Stefano, derive by contrast from hatred and selfish ambition. In The Tempest, love and its counterpart, imagination, win out. Prospero's rule of all the characters culminates in gentle admonitions rather than exacting justice. he trusts that the consciences of his enemies will be his allies. Prospero's rule is doomed unless there is a good recognizable by others and lovable. Not he, but that good must guarantee both the endurance of Prospero's refounding and the two young lovers' future wedded life. That love supports marriage is not hard to accept, but can one seriously claim that love can reform political life? It is never easy to render the good broadly effectual. Prospero is confident in the education he has been able to give Miranda, but is she equipped, perhaps, to rule someday in Italy? Her words are redolent of innocent trust and hyperbolic wonder. I'm quoting, "How beauteous mankind is, O brave new world that has such creatures in it," end quote. This comment elicits Prospero's calming, "'Tis new to thee." Somehow, Miranda combines unequivocal love for Ferdinand and the tendency to be overawed by humanity with awareness of the possibility of fraud and evil doing, but she has not thought through the problem of evil. Her fiancé, Prince Ferdinand, is worldlier, but he is evidently so starry-eyed and in love that he doesn't mind slavish and unaccustomed menial labor. Moreover, he wishes to remain on the island. Quote, "Let me live here ever, so rare a wondered father and a wise makes this place paradise," end quote. This is Ferdinand's response to the father of his beloved, a man who isn't taking any chances with his daughter's paramour. He threatens Ferdinand as he does Caliban and warns him that premarital lust will doom the marriage he and Miranda eagerly await. I'm quoting, "No sweet aspersion shall the heavens let fall to make this contract grow, but barren hate, sour-eyed disdain, and discord shall bestrew the union of your bed with weeds so loathly that you shall hate it both," end quote. If Gonzalo's observations are reliable, Ferdinand was lost not simply to his fellow shipwrecks, but morally, before Ariel led him to his lover. Perhaps he is being reformed. And yet, it would be surprising if Prospero's tests of his future son-in-law were enough to reform a bad character. Prospero must think he is essentially good and intelligent to boot, if in need of fatherly restraint. He has impressed Ferdinand with his command of the spirits who represent Iris, Ceres, and Juno in the nuptial pageant that celebrates Miranda's and Ferdinand's engagement. But Prospero must interrupt the pageant precipitously to attend to Caliban and his co-conspirators before they drive a nail through his head. The master cannot explain, but the audience must be painfully aware how Ferdinand's comparison should be revised to refer to Eden just before Satan's treachery. Before he goes off to deal with the snake-like Caliban, Prospero reveals to Ferdinand directly, addressing him as "my son," the reason his art can work on us. Quoting, "We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep," end quote. To be subjects of a ruler like Prospero, we must be like Ferdinand and Miranda, spirits who live primarily in images. The lovers are invited to attend to this aspect of themselves. For Prospero's project to succeed, Ferdinand must learn to subordinate his physical appetites to a higher sort of love. Caliban's nature must be kept tame. Antonio must be watched carefully. And Ariel must be freed. Will Ariel simply dissipate once Prospero frees him? Or is he a being in his own right? The play does not offer an explicit response to this question. All that is clear is that Prospero will no longer have a small army of spirits to help him subordinate the low to the high. Only if the souls of the characters have come to love and seek good can the return to Italy secure happiness. When Prospero gives up what he calls his rough magic, he is expressing his willingness to embark on his last journey before death, which will soon occupy, as he says, every third thought. But if his guidance ends with his life, Italy may be doomed to the rule of the next usurper. Or does nature, as Gonzalo imagines, ultimately support Prospero's efforts? how can the power of imagination, which Prospero so artfully exploits in the course of the play, be strong enough to maintain the effectuality of the good in a moral and political world filled with humans, not Shakespearean characters? To say the obvious, that we have imaginations and that images shape our lives to a remarkable extent, is not a sufficient response. Antonio, after all, is akin to his brother in at least one thing. He too has, and he says it, a strong imagination. Images vary, and Antonio's mind is filled with images of power. Prospero and Shakespeare have offered us new images to dwell upon, only if they are images of something true. If they can illuminate the lives of humans in their ordinary experience, can this play be said to present an alternative to Machiavellian politics? The Tempest contains a remarkable number of allusions to Plato's Republic. No actual tempest is described in that work, but there are three waves of the argument in Book 5. The first, to remind you, being the equal education of women in accord with nature. The second, bigger wave, is the community of women and children. And the third and biggest, the need for philosophers to become kings, or vice versa. In Book 6, Socrates refers to the true pilot of a ship who must tolerate the politicization of piloting, a situation in which even the knowledge of what it is to be truly capable of navigating is obscured. And later in that book, he refers to someone who belongs to the small group who, quote, keep company with philosophy, end quote, and finds himself in circumstances where, I'm quoting again, no one who minds the business of the cities does anything sound, and there is no ally with whom one could go to the aid of justice and be preserved, end quote. This man, more quotes, keeps quiet and minds his own business as a man in a storm, when dust and rain are blown about by the wind, stands aside under a little wall, end quote. Shakespeare's Prospero seems to have been just such a man, one who has since learned to use the forces of nature to his advantage to change the shape of his enemies' imaginations. Shakespeare's Tempest, then, is controlled by a kingly character who makes use of it in the task of reclaiming his dukedom and securing his daughter's future. The characters who inhabit the charmed island in The Tempest look like modified imitations of the parts of the city in speech and of the soul. Prospero is the wise ruler, a sort of poet king. Ariel is a tricksy spirit, longing to be free, but meanwhile conscientiously doing the bidding of Prospero and defending his regime. And Caliban is the lustful subhuman who resists superior authority while being incapable of governing himself. It takes all of Prospero's energy to maintain them in the proper order to serve good, and he does so successfully, with the help of magic. The only magic we see is nothing other than the art of poetry. In The Tempest, Shakespeare's art immerses us in the imaginary republic. He uses it to show that despite Machiavelli's insights into the dangers of pursuing imaginary republics, imagination deserves to be reconsidered as a guide for action. There's no doubt that imaginary states can be a distraction from political understanding, consoling us perhaps for our weakness and our failures. But the imagination can also serve as a tool for a true prince to manipulate in service of his calculated designs. Prospero's example suggests it may be even more, a way to see possibilities for good that sober reason forecloses. Without imagination, there is no love, at least no romantic love, and probably no human love at all. The City and Speech of Plato's Republic notoriously abolishes eros. References to women in that work nearly reduce their differences from men to the obvious reproductive ones. By contrast, the one quite young woman in The Tempest, driven first by pity and then by love, indirectly determines the whole action of the play and provides its greatest source of hope. For her sake, Prospero turns his understanding toward the practical application he eschewed back in Milan. Miranda's presence confirms Prospero's conversion into a sort of Machiavellian, rejecting the life of contemplation to turn toward the real constraints of human life. His sense of the injustice his brother did to him by usurping his dukedom is real, but it was not sufficient to motivate his attempt to order the larger European society he re-enters at the end of the play. On the island, necessity has compelled him to modify his earlier habit of spending all his time with his books. For 12 years now, he has had to use his knowledge to provide for his own and his daughter's survival. And to do so, he has had to govern the refractory elements and the inhabitants of the island. To complete his fatherly duties, Prospero must open up the possibility, apparently foreclosed by their exile, for Miranda to be a woman in contemporary Italy. The task he undertakes is formidable. Just as Machiavelli writes in the immediate context, to show anyone capable of unifying Italy that it is possible, Prospero demonstrates that the unification plotted by the King of Naples can be turned into a humane refounding of Prospero's Milan. He is cleverer than his enemies, but that is not all. His intention to provide for the possibility of love and happiness as well as for a more just political life is powerful because it can be shared. Plato's waves refer to provisions possible only among a few who are receptive. They are unlikely ever to compose an entire city. Prospero relies instead on image-induced repentance initiated by imagination and love, which are less rare. The three waves of the tempest I see are these: Prospero's and Miranda's provident survival of their watery exile. Second, Prospero's control of spirits, like Ariel, and of the elements, no mean task, but rather Baconian. Third, the repentance and consequent reform of the major traitors, or of Alonso at least. Shakespeare, with Prospero as his representative, aims at a revision of the cave, not the sort of rule that is consistent with the contemplation of things that are as the goal. For the sake of those they love, their children Ferdinand and Miranda, the new rulers must renew their concern with honor and justice. These standards, along with repentance and love rather than deference to truth, provide the motivating forces for a new kind of regime. Like the myth of Ur, Shakespeare's Tempest strives to vindicate poetry against Socrates' attack upon it in that work. Shakespeare's Tempest provides an image of the possibility of a well-ruled city, not in speech alone, but in dramatic action. In the midst of the storm, the true pilot regains control of the ship of state and puts it on its proper course. This requires fortuitous circumstances. The Italian ruling class sails right past Prospero's island, having just married off one of the two closest heirs to the throne of Naples in Africa. But it is possible. The Tempest reopens possibilities that Machiavelli's teachings seem to have closed. It revives political thought informed by the good. Almost done. Conclusion. Political thought focuses on the possible. Apart from the law of non-contradiction, the possible allows of no straightforward and certainly no thorough account. Politics, therefore, has constantly to be rethought and reinvented. There will be no definitive science of politics as long as there are human beings as we know them. Prospero's skill in creating images is his political art. He governs in such a way as to create new possibilities for happiness for as many as possible of the individuals he outwits and manipulates. They had become trapped by their own political machinations. There was no place, for example, for Alonso's affection for his son. His grief made him vulnerable to the second conspiracy initiated by Antonio, and there is no reason to think that would be the end of the Machiavellian machinations. Love, kindness, and forgiveness have no place in the constricted world of politics closed to the imaginary republics to which Prospero loves to attend. In the end, he gives up his rough magic, or at least its accoutrements. But does he give up the art they allowed him to practice? Do the possibilities for happiness and good government that emerge on Prospero's island remain? They do, if they are real. But what does it mean for possibilities to be real? The political art, as Prospero practices it, may be inspired by truths accessible to the contemplative mind, but it is an art so dependent upon images that their appropriate venue is the theater. Prospero's inventions are artifacts based on hope and pleasing to those who can suspend their everyday sense of reality. Shakespeare has Prospero come forth and beg of the audience the applause he needs to set him free. He, like Ariel, is a spirit who longs to dissipate in the air that is his natural medium. He makes a plea for the audience's empathy. In a move which makes explicit that his role is limited, he speaks these lines as a closing to the epilogue. "And my ending is despair unless I be relieved by prayer, which pierces so that it assaults mercy itself and frees all faults. As you from crimes would pardoned be, let your indulgence set me free." End quote. Prospero's aim, like Shakespeare's, was to please, to be sure. But the pleasure we take in the opening up of new possibilities is enhanced by our prior sense of constraint, the constraint we impose on ourselves by denying the effectuality of good in a world governed by ambition. When the audience claps and sets Prospero free from the magical island, acknowledging that the imaginative episode is over, they must choose whether to sink back into the constraints of political necessity or to bring back with them the image of the superior sort of freedom they have had the good fortune to encounter due to Shakespeare's art. Prospero asks us explicitly to display that freedom in a show of mercy, as he has, in the hope of receiving the same. To respond favorably is to allow this play to shape our imagination, at least temporarily, and to entertain Prospero's task as not only achievable, but in fact achieved. Shakespeare is often in dialogue with Machiavelli's teaching. Machiavelli teaches princes to focus on necessities and eschew imaginary republics. He uses the knowledge of necessity to open up the possibility of successful overthrow of established regimes, especially the regime of the Prince of Peace and his followers, Christianity. For the regime Christian leaders attempt to establish is in fact impossible, at least on this earth. To strive for it has led to the neglect of real possibilities for actual cities. But once Machiavelli reforms the political art by correcting the excesses of imagination, politics is subject to a new kind of tyranny, the tyranny of political necessity. Freedom from such tyranny does not have to result in the embrace of unrealizable fantasy. Poetry is the artful exploration of the possible in words and images. The poetic art is most suited to reopen the art of politics to the realizable possibilities Machiavellian hard-headed insistence on real constraints banishes from the minds of statesmen. Antonio succeeded in usurping power precisely because he was utterly obtuse to the enticement of the liberal arts that so entranced Prospero. When Prospero regains his authority, Antonio's vision is seen to be stunted. Shakespeare uses Prospero to show the defects of Machiavelli's instruction to princes. He demonstrates the power of poetry to capture the imaginations of an audience by placing before them images that remind us of a good we dimly perceive. Poetry is the natural companion and corrective to the political art. Like Prospero's and like Plato's, Shakespeare's art is only in part political. His drama tests the boundaries of the possible, sometimes altogether suspending its constraints. He uses the magic of the theater to provide a perspective upon the real from which problems that arise become more clearly visible. In The Tempest, Shakespeare offers us a temporary respite from political necessity in which the possible can be more clearly seen. He invites his audience on a voyage to a magical island governed by a poet king who loves knowledge and is inspired by his daughter, Miranda, Wonder. Through Prospero, Shakespeare explores the possibility that under favorable circumstances, political reality can be shaped by art, informed by a vision of the good. As the stage lights dim, the audience must use their own imagination, now freed from Machiavellian constraint, to maintain that vision. Thank you.